Thanks very much, Johnny. I'm going to have to quickly take three slides out of my presentation. But there you go. Thank you very much for a very nice introduction. As Johnny said, about 24 years ago I left UCT, and it was quite a surprise when I came back and was given my office and to discover that it was actually the office of my honours thesis supervisor. So every time I go to work in the morning, I keep expecting to see Professor Hotnady there moaning at me because I haven't been doing anything right. Then I sit down and realise that we're 24 years further forward from where I was back then. Before I start, I want to just say a few thank yous, because I know I'll forget at the end, and I'll probably run out of time at the end, so I might as well do the important stuff first. I wanted to start by thanking a few people who have been very important through my career. And I think the first of those is a South African, well known to many people working in global change, Professor Roland Schulze from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, who, when I was hunting around for a PhD topic, and the one proviso of that PhD topic was that there had to be more sunshine than there was at Cambridge when I was doing my fieldwork, he kindly agreed to host me at Pietermaritzburg and allow me to use their resources. And I spent nearly a year and a half there in 1994, including being here for the elections in 94, which was both a very enjoyable experience and also an introduction to the area of climate change and its impacts on water resources. Moving on from there, Mike Hume and Phil Jones, both at the University of East Anglia, were sort of my first postdoctoral supervisors and then collaborators, and they kind of threw me in the deep end of climate change detection work and climate modelling work and helped me move from, I guess, doggy paddle through to some semblance of swimming and managing to keep my head above water. And they really introduced me and set me on the trajectory of the career that I've followed since then. And I was very, very lucky to be in the right place at the right time, to end up being able to apply for a job with them that was sort of right at the takeoff of some of the most interesting climate change work that's been done. And then after moving to Oxford, soon after arriving at Oxford, a Professor Diana Liveman came to head up something called the Environmental Change Institute at ECI. And she's a much more of a social geographer. And she was instrumental in sort of leading me to the dark side, if you like, of the human dimensions of global change, which, as we all know now, when we're thinking about various aspects of global environmental change, we are dealing with a very coupled system of humans and environment mixed together in what people call a social ecological system. And you can't really understand that system unless you understand all components of it. And so she was really, really useful in both sort of introducing me to those ideas, but also being a true interdisciplinarian and being one of the few people who actually understands some of the challenges of working in an interdisciplinary environment. And that was very, very helpful as I moved from, I guess, pure climate science through into something that's much more interdisciplinary. So finally, I need to thank my family, who've been around with me all the way, particularly Carolyn and Tom and Georgie, who've put up with me being not there some of the time when I've been off doing field research either in Africa or in South America or in the Himalayas, and more recently as an absentee father or husband as we've been transitioning from Oxford to Cape Town. And without their support, particularly this latest career move, wouldn't have been possible, and they've sacrificed a lot to enable me to come here ahead of them and start kicking off this very, very exciting initiative. Right, so what I want to do is take you through a number of themes around this issue of climate and development, and woven through those themes is some of the work that I've been doing over the last 20-odd years. Not all of it, and you'll see from many of the slides that I show and the pictures that I show that I draw on the work of other people, that my work has really threaded a path through many of the important aspects that I'm going to be talking about. And so we're going to go through sort of a series of phases thinking about and talking about what we actually mean by climate change and development and what the issues are. I want to start with a very nice set of slides by Will Steffen, who really sort of shows exactly the problem we're dealing with. Now, we don't need to look at the details of these, but this is essentially a set of graphs showing socio-economic trends from essentially the start of the Industrial Revolution through to the present. And just what you can see there with those grey curves is that each of those trends is showing an accelerating increase to increasingly higher values. Now, some of those are, for instance, population growth, a rapid increase in population growth, traffic, McDonald's restaurants, and dams to capture water that we need to use. So essentially what we're saying is that associated with population growth and increasing economic growth, we're seeing trends in a whole lot of other aspects of the, if you like, the socio-economic side of this coupled system that I talked about that are driving change in the Earth system. And then if we look at, if you like, environmental indexes, we see something similar. So this is a range of environmental indexes, ranging from, I don't know, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That didn't work. Anyway, but and various other aspects like natural disasters and so on. Now, what's clear is that there's a strong correlation between many of those socioeconomic indicators and the environmental indices that we're measuring. Now, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation, but if we read the literature that's been emerging over the last 10 to 15 years, in many instances, these environmental indices that are correlated with the socioeconomic indices, it's becoming clear that they're actually being caused by some of these socioeconomic drivers. So beyond reasonable doubt, we can say that the increase in global mean temperature and regional temperatures is driven by carbon dioxide levels, which is driven by fossil fuel burning. In many other instances with some of these other indices, we can say the same thing. At worst, we can say that the balance of probability suggests that there's a human cause to any of these indices. Now, for the lawyers in the audience, like Dani, as I understand it, in the civil court of law, often you only have to prove the balance of probability to have a valid case. So in nearly all these indices, we're either beyond reasonable doubt, to use a legal term, or we have a strong case for a civil court case, if I wanted to, that these environmental trends we're seeing are driven by human activity. Right. So what that leads us to is something that Paul Crutzen has called the Anthropocene. Now, Paul Crutzen is a Nobel Prize-winning scientist who was involved in work on the ozone layer and has been involved in global change work ever since there. But essentially what he's saying is that the sorts of environmental trends that we're seeing are changing the signature of the geology that's being laid down across the Earth in a way that we're seeing a different signal to anything that we've seen in the past. So if one of my geologist friends was teleported a couple of million years into the future and they took a core down through some record, what they'd see is this spike in environmental indicators that was unprecedented anywhere in geological history. A bit like we see a spike in various indicators that tell us that a large meteor struck the Earth at the end of the Cretaceous and potentially wiped out the dinosaurs, we'd be seeing similar spikes in the geological record, which means that we're moving from a natural geological epoch into what he's called the Anthropocene. So from the Holocene, which is the last geological epoch, into a human epoch, a human-caused geological epoch. So essentially what that means is that we are, for the first time, seeing humans actually playing a significant role in the Earth system, an ability to actually change the way the Earth system operates. What I want to do next is sort of think now about what this Anthropocene actually means for human welfare and the Earth system. I want to start off with something, a concept that's come out quite recently called planetary boundaries. And this is the idea that humans are interacting with the Earth system and pushing various components of the Earth system in directions where it probably hasn't been, at least in the last 10,000 years, and maybe even the last few million years. And this shows various indicators or planetary boundaries that that these authors considered, and they relate to carbon dioxide, the obvious one, water, land cover, biodiversity loss. And what they've done is said, okay, well, what's a threshold that maybe pushes the Earth system out of where its comfort zone is? And they chose a particular threshold. So for carbon dioxide, they said, well, we think a boundary that is beyond natural is around 350 parts per million. Where are we now? We're nearly at 400 parts per million. So that top segment there shows, that top orange segment, shows how far beyond the boundary we are on the climate change front. That green ring, if you like, is the environmental ceiling, that safe operating space, the planetary boundary within which we shouldn't be perturbing the Earth system. And as you can see, a couple of those wedges are already beyond that ring, that environmental ceiling. Biodiversity loss, rates of loss greater than 10 species per year, which is kind of the natural background level. We're sitting well over 100. And some of the others are equivalent. Then we've got other parts of the Earth system, for instance, like ocean acidification, that bottom right wedge, which are approaching that threshold. Ocean acidification is also caused by carbon dioxide emission, but it prevents calcareous oceanic organisms from actually forming their shells. And when the acidity gets too high, their ability to actually produce the shells within which they live is hampered. So we're approaching, if you like, a planetary boundary on that front. So this is one way of thinking about where human activity in the Anthropocene is pushing the Earth system and pushing it outside of certainly the conditions that humans have experienced during the time of human evolution, or at least modern human evolution. Now, more recently, there's a very interesting work that's come out of Oxfam in the UK, which has said, well, that's all very well. These authors have come up with a framework for thinking about what might be the environmental limits to sustainable use of the Earth. But what about the people living on the Earth? And so they've come with this concept of a social foundation, which is, if you like, a certain minimum level of human development that's just and fair. And they've chosen a whole lot of indexes that are very closely related to, for instance, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment indices around food security, water, sanitation, healthcare, energy, and some that are slightly more nebulous around voice, so political ability to be heard within political and decision-making space, jobs and resilience. And what they've done there is essentially shown the proportion of the global population that fall below this threshold. So for food security, 15% of the world's population are insecure or are suffering from malnutrition. And that reflects that gap, if you like, on the food wedge between the orange and the green, which is where we want to get to. So the blue is the gap. So what they're saying is, fine, we've got an operating limit from an environmental point of view, but there's also a development imperative that says we want, for a fair and just world, we would actually like to move at the very bare minimum everybody so that all of those wedges actually are across that green barrier. So what they've come up with is something that we now colloquially call the donut. So instead of having a planetary boundary or a social foundation, We have that green area in between, which is the area between where we would like human development to get to in terms of human well-being and the limits to what the Earth system can actually provide in terms of resources. And that's what they call a safe and just space for humanity. Safe in the sense it's below the environmental threshold, and just because it means that everybody has reached a certain level of well-being and human security. And this is essentially this operating band within which we have to be operating if we're thinking about bringing sustainability into play at the same time as development. So, how are we doing? Well, here's a kind of a, we all hate indices sometimes, but this is one way of looking at how we're doing in sort of finding the safe operating space. Along the bottom axis there is a measure of human well-being, the Human Development Index, which would be familiar to a lot of people. It's essentially a multi-variable measure of human well-being at a national scale. And along the x-axis is an ecological footprint defined as the global hectares of space used per person to deliver the standard of living that they actually are achieving at the moment. So what you see, unsurprisingly, is at the top right there, the USA is sitting with a very high human development index, but quite a large global hectare, a global ecological footprint. Every person in the US uses up about 8 hectares of land a year in terms of resources. We go down to some of the poorer nations in the world, all the browns and the dark browns, those are sitting in Africa and Asia, a very low human development index and a low ecological footprint. And if we look across to the right, to that yellow rectangle, that's in a way the safe operating space, because we want to shift everybody across to have a human development index somewhere in the range of 0.8 to 1. But we want to do it without moving above that ecological footprint of 2 hectares per person. And that little yellow rectangle is remarkably empty at the moment. And that's, in essence, what the sustainable development challenge is finding ways of shifting people so that they have a what we'd consider a just level of welfare and well-being without essentially using up too many planets at the same time. So if we summarize that, this is where we are at the moment. This is essentially another measure of that footprint, but averaged up globally. And what we're seeing here is, essentially that value of 1 is the renewable rate at which which the globe can use the ecological resources that are available. It's a very complicated index, but essentially what you see there is that somewhere in the 70s, we started using more than one planet in terms of the renewable ecological resources that are available, and that trend has been continuing ever since. So sustainable development from an ecological and human well-being point of view requires us to bring that curve back down below 1 or close to 1. Okay, what I want to do next is talk a bit more about what I know about, which is that one of those wedges, if you like, which is the climate change wedge. And then follow that on by talking a little bit more about how that climate change wedge interacts with many of those aspects that affect human welfare, like water and food, human security, etc. If we look at climate as a driver of human welfare, it operates in a number of different ways. First of all, climate's actually a very strong environmental control on the natural resource that's available in any particular place. Climate creates a set of inputs through water, heat, sunlight, etc., that actually control a number of different aspects around the ecology that is occurring in a particular place. It even controls the patterns of biodiversity around the world at a macro scale. So climate's important in terms of the raw resource that's available, if you like, but it's also very important through the way that climate varies. And it's through climate variations and climate shocks that we see some of the biggest impacts on human welfare. And this just shows three of the, or four of the ways that, that climate variations or perturbations can affect human welfare through drought, leading to famine, through flood, and through various diseases that are related to climatic disasters. Now this shows the sort of distribution over over Africa of climatic-related disasters over the last 30 years or so. But what it doesn't show is how those have been changing over time. And here's an example of the sort of change that we've been seeing over the last 20 or 30 years. And what you see at the bottom there with that sort of brownish curve are what people call geological hazards. And those are earthquakes, landslides, etc. They haven't really been changing very much, but the other colours, and particularly related to floods and storms, and to some extent some of the other weather-related events, have been showing an increasing trend over the time period. This relates to exactly what I was talking about at the outset, where we have an underlying perturbation of the climate system that's producing, it would seem, an increasing number of climate and weather-related extreme events. So those affect society in a number of different ways and at a number of different scales. For example, let's look at Ethiopia. This graph simply shows rainfall variations over a period from the 80s through to the end of the 90s, and that's the brown graph, and then two curves, the line curves, which show the change in GDP growth, either just from the agricultural sector or from the total sector, the total GDP, through the same time period. And it doesn't take a statistical wizard to see that there's a strong correlation there between rainfall anomalies and both agricultural and total GDP output. And this is typical of many, many African countries and developing countries where the economy is very dependent on agricultural output. In fact, other work shows that for a 1% increase in the area of a country under drought, you get about 3 to 4% decrease in GDP. So if you have a drought year in a country in Africa where you just have a slight increase in the area under drought, it has a very big impact on GDP. So that sort of at the national scale, you can see the way climate actually does impact on national well-being and presumably by disaggregation through into individual well-being as well. Climate also affects individuals. I don't know how many of you know what an antlion is. Most of you should do. How many of you have actually thrown an ant in an antlion trap and watched it? Come on, put your hands up. Who's ever done that? I've done it. I still do it. Okay. So what happens? The ant goes in, falls into this trap, starts scrabbling up to fall out, and just as it's about to get out, the antlion flicks some sand up and the whole thing falls away and it collapses down again. And that's a very nice analogy for this concept of poverty traps, which is if you think of individual households who are very related or very dependent on the natural environment for their income and well-being, well, that means most of rural Africa, they spend a lot of their time actually trying to climb out of this poverty trap. But then a climate shock comes along, or a health shock, or another shock, and knocks them back down. So all of the resources that they have, that they are creating on a year-to-year basis, essentially is used in trying to recover from shocks, rather than move their general well-being into some new level. And they never actually, well, many communities, villages, people, households, never actually get over that threshold that enables them to accumulate resources to build up resilience to the shocks that are going to be coming. They continually, essentially, run into standstill at best. So climate and other shocks affect African societies from the individual right up to the economic level, and clearly is an important factor when one's thinking about how the Anthropocene, if you like, our influence on the Earth system is then related to development. Right, so let's talk about climate in a bit more detail then. If we believe and take the sort of the international line on things, what we really want to be doing in terms of climate change negotiations is avoiding what we call a plus 2 degrees centigrade Earth, an Earth that warms more than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Because all the evidence suggests that as you move beyond that 2 degree global warming, the damages caused by climate start to become significant and heavy and actually start to outweigh the costs of avoiding that 2 degrees. Now, a very simple way to think about this is in terms of carbon budgets. And it's very, very convenient that roughly, to have an equal chance, 50-50 chance, of staying below 2 degree warming, we need to emit over the whole sort of period of industrialization from 1870 through to sometime around 2300, no more than 1 trillion tons of carbon. Okay, that's the budget we have to work with. Where we are at the moment, as of yesterday, is a little over halfway through that budget. So we've actually used up more than half of that cake, about 55% of that cake. And most of that has been used up by the industrialized world, but increasingly the cake that's being eaten up now is by the industrializing world. So the Chinas, the Brazils, the South Africas, the Indias of this world. So we're over halfway through the cake. And if you think about the rest of Africa, South Africa and maybe Nigeria apart, they're essentially a very small contributor to global emissions. So in theory, they should be having quite a big slice of the cake that's left. But I'm afraid the party's already finished, the cake's been sliced, and everybody's run off with the slices. There's no carbon left for the developing world if we want to keep below this 2 degree threshold. If we're happy with 3 degrees, that's fine. We've got another trillion tons of carbon to work with. If we're happy with 4 degrees, we've got 3 trillion tons to work with, and so on. But if we really are serious about this 2 degree threshold, we are rapidly running out of carbon that's left over. So essentially what we then have to do is think about what the challenges are in actually transitioning out of a carbon-based energy system rapidly enough that we only use up another half a trillion tons of carbon. And effectively what that means is if we think about emissions, which is what this graph shows, annual emissions, what you're interested in there is the area under the curve. That's the cumulative carbon emissions, that's the carbon budget we're interested in. And what those graphs show are what one has to do in terms of reducing emissions and the rate of emissions depending on when emissions peak. So the green curve, I think it peaks in 2015. If global emissions peak in 2015, we can reduce emissions at 3% per annum and keep within budget. If we delay until 2025, which is the blue curve, then we've got to reduce emissions much, much faster. In fact, at 8% per year, which most economists tell me is going to have a significant hit on GDP, and in fact is one of the big problems, is that the economists are telling the politicians that if you cut emissions that fast, then GDP growth is going to be hit by rates that are going to lose you in your next election. So here we have a slight political economic problem that we have to deal with. I want to illustrate that with one quick example, because part of the impasse in the global negotiations, never mind national budgets, is the battle between what we call non-Annex I countries, essentially the non-developed countries or the emerging economies, and what are called Annex I countries, the developed economies. And I want to give you an example of the issue that we have here. So, sort of justice would say that the non-Annex I countries, the emerging economies, should be the ones who have the rest of the cake, or a large proportion of the rest of that carbon cake. So here's one example of what non-Annex I countries could be doing, including South Africa, China, India, etc. If they, global non-Annex I, developing country, emerging economy emissions peaked in 2025 and declined by 4% a year, which is economically tough but probably doable, what does that leave the rest of the world, the developed world? Well, essentially, It leaves them with that. We have to peak in 2015. They have to peak. I keep saying we because I used to be in the UK. They have to peak in 2015 and then switch out the lights, stop flying, stop driving to work, ride bicycles and grow vegetables in their back garden because they can't buy beans from Kenya anymore. Okay. That's, in a nutshell, that's an extreme example. There are other sort of versions of this that give a little more wiggle room. But that's essentially what the impasse is around, is that there's just not enough cake to go around if we're talking about 2 degrees. And so the reality is that we're not going to hit that target. The system that we're in is much too inertial. Transitioning energy systems out of carbon into something else is just takes time. The technology's there. The infrastructure and the socio-political inertia is actually what makes it impossible. So, the long and the short of that is that 2 degrees is out of the window. It's a good policy target, but in reality we should be planning for something else. We should still be actually targeting 2 degrees because we don't want slippage on objectives, but if we're thinking about coping with climate change, we need to be thinking about quite different numbers to that 2 degree number. And if we look at what's come out of the negotiations so far, we don't have any binding agreements, but we have a whole set of promises written on the back of an envelope at Copenhagen, and sort of some of the envelopes went lost, and some of them were all crumpled or whatever. But if we look at essentially what's been promised from a voluntary perspective, this is what we're guaranteed if those voluntary promises come to fruition. A 50-50 chance of avoiding 3.5 degrees by sometime in a peak temperature of 3.5 degrees. A 95% chance, so we're nearly 100% sure that we'll keep below 4.4 degrees. So what we're going to have to be dealing with, if we take a realistic view, is somewhere in that range, from about 2 degrees to about 4.4 degrees. That's if everything works out. Hopefully, we're all optimists, and in 2015 we have an agreement that does help us get below this, so we might be somewhere between the 3.5 and the 2 degree boundary. But 2 degrees is history, folks. What happens if everybody becomes selfish and everything fails? Well, business as usual keeps us on the trajectory that we're on at the moment. By 2050, somewhere between 2 and nearly 3.5 degrees of warming. By the end of the century, somewhere between 4 and maybe 7 degrees of warming. And this is where we do take that Earth system way out of the space it's been operating in for the last, well, since the dinosaurs were roaming around almost, or certainly till since 20 or 30 million years ago. Okay, so it's very easy to talk about global numbers like that. 2 degree globally, 2 degree global warming, 3 degree global warming. What does it actually mean? It means different things to different people, depending on where you are. So at a broad scale, what this map shows are two of the key climate phenomena that affect human well-being. On the left, temperature, and on the right, rainfall. What it's showing is a mid-range sort of change, and the difference from just about today, 2010, in 2050. So not very far away, less than 40 years away. The left graph is quite nice, because that actually shows the relative change in temperature compared to that global temperature that's experienced in 2050. So what you can see there is a very big variation in the pattern of local temperature changes that are associated with a given global temperature change, a policy target, if you like. For various reasons relating to loss of snow and ice, the Arctic especially warms enormously by maybe up to 10 degrees in some places, certainly more than 4 or 5. But the other pattern that comes across is that the continents warm much more than the oceans, at least over the 20th century, because the oceans act to draw down heat. They're a big sink of heat. Land is like it's a bit like a hot rock which you sit on at sunset. It keeps you warm. It absorbs heat much more easily. And the other fact you can see there is that the subtropics, if we look at the tropics to the subtropics warm more than the tropics. And if we look at Southern Africa there, you can see that that's, in essence, a hotspot of regionally enhanced warming. So for South Africa, a 2 degree warming means about a 2 degree global warming means about a 3 to 3.5 degree local warming. So 2 degrees means a very different thing for farmers in South Africa than it does for farmers in the tropics or perhaps in the mid latitudes. The other map shows changes in rainfall, fundamental to many aspects of human well-being. And what we see there is everywhere that's orange, decreasing rainfall in terms of our best guess of what's going to happen, and everywhere that's blue, increasing rainfall. And in fact, globally, rainfall increases because global warming actually speeds up the hydrological cycle. You get more evaporation, what goes up must come down, so you get more rain. But the distribution of that increased global rainfall is very unevenly distributed. And if there's a take-home message, it's essentially that areas that are dry today get drier, and areas that are wet today get wetter. So we are exaggerating existing patterns of stress in terms of rainfall as a driver of climate shocks. So what does that mean in terms of some of the things that are important to well-being? Well, here's one example from agriculture. What this is showing is essentially for two different time periods, 2025 and 2050, under a middle-of-the-range type scenario, the change in the area of any individual country where the maize that they currently grow within that country is actually going to be suitable in the future. Or will they have to bring in new maize varieties from outside of that country? And what you see is that by 2050, many African countries that are currently growing maize, a staple crop, actually are going to have to bring in new maize varieties. Varieties that are more heat tolerant and probably more water tolerant, water stress tolerant. What does that mean? Well, it means that we have to think about different breeding objectives. The Green Revolution is all about increasing productivity. Throw fertilizers on, throw water on, and you grow as much as you can. Drought and heat tolerant plants may not actually be the same species that maximize yield. So we may actually still be able to grow maize there with crops that are more tolerant, but their actual yields may be lower because we're optimizing them for other factors. So that looks pretty gloomy, but we have to realize that crops type and crop yield are only part of the picture in terms of food production in any context, and particularly in the African context. For many farms, and particularly smallholder farming, yields are about 30% of the potential yield that you could get if those farms were farmed in the way that an agricultural research station is farmed. So for various reasons around lack of resources, inputs, water shortages, farming methods, African crop yields are generally way below their potential. So even if we had lower crops that produce lower yields, by improved farming practices, we could maybe overcome that shortfall. Then the other big aspect relates to efficiency. In Africa, at least about 30% of food that's grown never reaches the table, it's never eaten, it's wasted, it's lost. Figures that's due to various issues around storage and other factors. And that's pretty much a global statistic, although the reasons in other parts of the world are because we throw away most of what we buy and put it in the dustbin. So one could actually, we could get away with growing a lot less food if the food was actually used in an efficient manner. So all that we're seeing here is that we've got one stress, we've got room for maneuver, but we're going to have to change business as usual if we're going to cope with this new additional stress that's emerging. The other big factor across much of the world and much of the dry parts of the world relates to water. Now, here we've got a couple of different drivers, as with most environmental stresses and most environmental resources. This shows for all the major river basins of the world what the change in water stress is going to be just due to population growth. So in other words, the number of people, in other words, additional people in the world that are going to need water, access to safe water And you can see there that with red being areas that have an increase in water stress, Africa's like is the hotspot for increased water stress. Just about every major river basin is going to have increased water stress due to population growth, because essentially Africa is the hotspot for population growth going forward in time. If we compare now a couple of different factors, which is population, climate change, and then combined population and climate, we'll see here on the left that climate does add to water stress. And over Africa as well, and many other parts of the world, we're getting kind of pinks and light oranges. So increases in stress because the raw water resource is decreasing, because rainfall's decreasing generally and evaporation is increasing. But the colours are much less intense than the population one. And in fact, from a water perspective, the driver of water stress in the future is primarily demand for water from an increasing population, which hopefully will be better off economically and be using more water. And superimposed upon that is climate as an added stressor. So it's an additional stressor rather than a prime stressor, if you like. So climate change interfaces with development issues in different ways, depending on the sort of slice that you're taking through the development picture. Okay. Just to sort of add a further level of complication, what I wanted to do now was zoom in on South Africa, still quite broad brush, but just show some of the uncertainties that we're dealing with. Because the previous slides that I've shown are all about essentially a best guess of what could happen. But that best guess hides quite a wide range of possibilities. And if we just look at these two key climatic indices, at the top, trends in just annual temperature averaged over South Africa, and at the bottom, trends in annual rainfall, and these are changes from the long-term average that we're used to. You'll see that we have different colours there. Each colour and each band associated with that colour represents a different emissions feature: high emissions, medium low emissions. So essentially the carbon dioxide factor that produces a spread. And then the spread in each band relates to our uncertainty around how the climate system is going to respond to that particular amount of carbon dioxide forcing. So for temperature, if we go to the end of the century, depending on the combination of emissions and climate system response at the regional scale, we could be seeing a global warming of anywhere between maybe 1.5 and 6 degrees. That's the uncertainty that we have to deal with when we're planning the future from a climate change perspective. Rainfall is even harder, because we don't even know the magnitude of change in South Africa, the direction of change. If you look at that sort of average middle of the road picture there, we're around about zero change with maybe a slight decrease in rainfall. But we can't rule out increased rainfall, and we can't rule out decreased rainfall. So there we've got essentially a bit of a black box that we have to cope with. Okay, what I want to do now is talk about some of the issues that we have to deal with when we're thinking about responding to climate change. And I want to contrast two examples. One briefly I'm going to talk about, which is the example of sort of near-term issues. So if we think about how a farmer planning what crop to plant next year deals with climate change, it's not really an issue, because they can change the crop that they plant year by year. So they can actually adapt to the emerging climate risk, provided they have the right resources and facilities in a very flexible manner. An apple farmer in Elgin may actually have a slightly longer time scale, because the cycle for replanting apple trees might be 10 years or something like that. So if they're choosing a particular species to plant, they need to know what sort of climate they're going to be coping with in a 10-year cycle. But there are lots of decisions that have much longer-term decision timescales around them, up to 100 years even. This is a nice example that was actually produced by an extreme event, which may be climate change related, which are the enormous fires that hit Victoria in South Australia a couple of years ago. Wiped out whole areas of conservation area. So huge areas of natural forest totally wiped out. And so from a conservation perspective, the question was, okay, how do we restore what's been destroyed? Okay. Everything's gone. What do we do to with the restoration process? And here we have a bit of a dilemma, because this is the current, if you like, ecosystem, a mix of two different key tree species that coexist in a mosaic of different tree species. But those trees are going to be coming to maturity 60, 70, 80 years in the future. So if you're replanting this nature reserve, what do you plant it with? Well, this is the sorts of ecosystems that there could be in the future. If we are successful and keep below 2 degrees, we'll probably end up with the climate space allowing a similar ecosystem to what's there at the moment. If we have a runaway or an extreme climate scenario, we could end up with a completely new ecosystem with actually new species coming in that are suited to the new climate that's there. Or somewhere in between, maybe having a transition system that's a mix of what was there and these new species that are more suited. So how do you replant when you don't know what the outcome is going to be in 60 years' time? Well, what they did here was they took essentially a hedging approach. If they knew what was going to happen, for instance, a recovery, they could have planted everything with mountain ash and the mesamate species. What they did was they planted a whole range of different species in the knowledge that some of those plantings weren't going to be there and go to maturity because they wouldn't be suited for the climate that it would evolve. So essentially, it's a suboptimal response, but it's a robust response. So you actually, you are coming up with a plan that probably costs more than if you knew exactly what was going to happen, but keeps your options open and gives you much more flexibility to respond to that uncertainty. And that's where we have to be thinking about adapting to climate change, particularly for the long time frame decisions. So things like crop breeding, thinking about water resource infrastructure. We need to be thinking about putting in plans that allow for robustness or resilience across a range of possible futures, rather than the traditional engineering approach, if you like, which is the optimal solution for the parameters that you've been given. Okay, just to finish off then, I want to try and bring, at least from a climate change perspective, things together, the emissions and the energy side and the climate impact side. And I want to start off with one scenario. This is sort of a standard UN middle of the road population scenario for Africa as a whole. Moving from a population of 1 billion a couple of years ago to 2 billion in 2050, and somewhere over 3 billion by the end of the century. That makes Africa the region, the continent, with the greatest increase in population growth over the next century. Asia comes second, growing and peaking and declining by sometime in the second half of the century. Okay, so now let's just imagine that Africa grows like this and actually manages to satisfy its development imperative, which is raising everybody to some agreed just level for a human development index, above 0.8, for instance. And imagine they do that using the Chinese model or the US model or perhaps even the South African model. So a carbon-based energy system. Well, that's what we get in terms of trillion tons of carbon emitted if we assume that each person in Africa emits the same as these different countries are currently emitting in terms of carbon intensity, that's emissions per head. So for China, it actually has a lower carbon intensity than South Africa at the moment, about 5 tons carbon per head. South Africa around about 9. The US, obscenely high at somewhere like 18, I can't remember. But if we think about what that means in terms of that trillion tons of carbon, if we just follow South Africa's path, okay, and if the rest of Africa follows South Africa's path and sticks to essentially a carbon-based economy to the end of the century, then we are sitting at 500 billion tons of carbon, an additional half a trillion tons, because that cake's already been used up by China and India. If we follow the US route, well then, lots of cakes out there. And if we follow the China route, we're still adding significantly to that cumulative loading. And what does that mean in terms of climate impacts in Africa? Well, this is just global temperature. That red curve that I've added in there is, if you like, the policy target. That's keeping global temperature change below 2 degrees. And that we can do with a 50-50 chance if we keep emissions, cumulative emissions, below that trillion tons. And those other curves there are the added climate change coming just from Africa following a development pathway that is carbon-based. Okay? So if we follow the Chinese route, we add 1.5 degrees of warming globally by end of the century. If we follow the South African route, three-quarters of a degree. The South African route, we add a degree. If we follow the US route, well, I don't know where it ends up. It's somewhere around about 5 or 6 degrees. Okay. So this is where, if you like, energy, the energy side of climate, and the development side of climate actually come to rest in a challenge for Africa. Because just at the moment when Africa is actually seeking to replicate, at least economically, what the rest of the world has done, it can't do it through a carbon-based approach. Because if it does, it sows the seeds of its own destruction. It adds those wedges of carbon on that produce levels of climate change, that produce impacts that impact on development. So it's this sort of catch-22 situation. So basically, the message from that is, Africa has to find another development pathway. It can't be the same as the existing emerging economies if it wants to have both reduce extreme climate damages and at the same time improve economic well-being. So essentially what we're saying is, if we go back to this ecological footprint, is all those brown dots have to somehow move sideways into that yellow area. And at the same time, in terms of global equity, all the green and red dots have to move down into that area in terms of global equity. That's quite a challenge. Some would say it's impossible. I think it's not necessarily impossible. We actually know how to do quite a bit of it. From the carbon side, we already actually have the technology and the tools to do it. We just have a system that is in a state of inertia, and at least in terms of the energy system and a political system that's in a state of, not quite denial, but gridlock, if you like. In terms of the other aspects of sustainability, the other natural capital that we have to draw on, well, we can learn a lot from the carbon story, I think. So half of the problem in terms of the energy story is actually efficiency. We can probably just today, by increasing efficiency, get rid of one third of the problem. By switching into, taking all those 12-year-old cars in America that have 3-litre engines and throwing them out the window, and doing similar things everywhere, we can actually get rid of one third of the problem. And then shifting our energy systems is the other two thirds of the problem. In the other terms of natural resources, efficiency is really important. And then we need to actually reuse and recycle. We have a very, if we think about the American model, it's basically a consume and discard model of use of the natural resources. And that discarding and rate of consumption is at a rate that's faster than the natural world is able to renew itself. So that can be done, and recycling and reuse is the way to go, but it actually takes a lot of energy. So a lot of recycling and actually uses energy as well. So what do we need to... We just said that we don't have to worry about energy if we actually get our act together. So solving the climate change problem actually solves part of the sustainability problem, because we're providing clean energy that enables us to use that energy and other aspects of sustainability from a technological point of view. It's not the whole solution, but they are linked together in a very, very interesting way. But I think the other key thing here, and this comes back to Oxfam's point at the beginning, we have to change what we have at the moment, which is an extreme range in distribution in terms of the spread of well-being and consumption. And we actually need a global middle class, because it's only a global middle class that's actually going to consume. It has to actually be quite an ecologically minded global middle class, but it's only a global middle class that can consume at rates that actually have some potential for falling within the safe operating space. I wanted to finish off with this cartoon, which is a Gary Larson cartoon from a long, long time ago. Long, in fact, I think before climate change. But it's always struck me as really, really, really funny. What we can do is actually sort of modernize that. I think this is from the 70s, this cartoon, and put in a few different faces here, and change the caption a bit. And there's a big difference between us and dinosaurs. First of all, we're not helpless victims of climate shocks. We actually are producing those climate shocks. And secondly, I think we've got brains that are bigger than walnuts or peanuts or whatever. And so we should actually be able to come up with some solutions. The main problem, I think, is getting all those brains to work together rather than actually the brain power that we have. So in conclusion, it's a tough challenge, I think, that we face in South Africa, in Africa, globally. I think we, with some sort of margins of error, we can find a safe operating space, but it's going to require quite significant changes and indeed transformations to the way society actually operates at the moment. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge, because I wonder how many of you actually rode a bicycle to this lecture or caught a bus. I'm not saying that I'm any different, but we're very good at worrying about the meta problems and not very good at worrying about what we have to do, either personally or politically, as a voter, as a politician, to actually induce, as a businessman, as a business leader, to actually induce these transformations that are needed. Thank you very much.
Mark. Very clear, very comprehensive, very understandable. It is now my great pleasure to request Professor Mike Meadows to give the voting points.
Thank you, and good evening. I'm very pleased, actually, that the Acting Vice-Chancellor mentioned this strong relationship that we have between the University of Cape Town, in particular, my own department, Environmental and Geographical Science, where, by the way, Mark has an additional office to the one he also holds in Geological Sciences. That relationship is indeed very strong. Those of you who know anything at all about this peculiar garb that we wear from time to time as academics may know that the red one is actually a UCT one, the red gown, the UCT PhD gown that Mark is wearing, as well as the Oxford gowns, the same, exactly the same pattern. This one happens to be a Cambridge one. So I'm delighted that the Acting Vice-Chancellor mentioned the Oxford relationship. And indeed mentioned the boat race, because it now means I don't have to mention the boat race and the fact that Cambridge won it. And by the way, it's not true that Cambridge paid that fellow to jump in the water and pull the boat when it was obvious that Oxford was about to win. I had occasion this morning to visit the UCT archives down on Main Road in Mowbray. One imagines these places to be very dusty and dark and dank, but actually it's really quite a pleasant working space. And I went there with the task of looking at the files of the first ever professor of geography at the University of Cape Town, Bill Talbot, who joined the university in 1936. And I don't know whether I'm breaking protocol here, because I know that selection committee proceedings are supposed to be confidential, but I think 70-odd years later, it might be okay to reveal that in Bill Talbot's application letter, he said that the chair offers to a serious scientist an opportunity to enter upon an attractive field of teaching and research in which a man would be well content to employ the whole of his active life. Now, Mark, I don't know if you intend to spend the rest of your active life at the University of Cape Town, but believe me, the challenge that faces you in the ACDI and the job you have as Pro-VC is certainly, potentially at least, a life's work. It's fundamentally interdisciplinary, and there are enormous, extraordinary challenges actually to doing interdisciplinary work. Institutions like UCT are, I'm very proud to say, by their nature, as research leaders, they're progressive, they're forward-thinking, but they're also enormous inertias at establishments such as this. Some people call them silos, the faculties and the departments, and it marks one of Mark's tasks, I think, to attempt to break those barriers down, and I'm very pleased to see that in the few months that he's been with us, or back with us really in a sense, some of that work, I believe, is already beginning to pay off. Mark also spoke about pushing boundaries, pushing boundaries of resource sustainability, pushing boundaries towards, in a sense, the requirements for humanity and the donor model of how we need to try and occupy, if we can, that safe and just space for humanity. If we are to do that, it needs to be based on research and teaching that is rooted in sound science, and I know personally from Mark's work that it's very much a sound scientist. He's an outstanding scientist, but it's science that needs to be based on reality, pragmatism. It's research, in other words, and teaching that is socially responsive, and also, as we saw in this slide, politically engaged. And it's my sense from what Mark has said and the experience I've had with him over the last few months is that that is indeed the task of the African Climate and Development Initiative, is to bring some of that social responsiveness and political engagement through doing absolutely sound teaching and research in good science. And I think in that sense, ladies and gentlemen, you'll agree with me, it's abundantly clear that that initiative is in very, very good hands indeed. Professor Martin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much to Professor Meadows. We have now come to the end of the formal part of the evening. And you are invited to meet for refreshments outside, to engage with Mark, congratulating, talk about the lecture, and generally network. And thank you very much for coming. What is going to happen next is that the platform party will then make its way outside, and after that, you are welcome to join us. Thank you very much.